From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Yesterday in Salt Lake City, Americans swept in the men's snowboarding halfpipe event. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with snowboarder Chris Klug, who competes later this week in the parallel giant slalom. He competed in 1998 in Nagano, the first time that snowboarding was included in the Winter Games. This year, he enters the Games as America's top alpine snowboarder. Pretty amazing, considering that 1.5 years ago, he had a liver transplant. Also, we talk with trombonist and composer Roswell Rudd about his path from traditional jazz to the avant-garde, and rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by hip-hop artist Princess Superstar. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Enron chairman Kenneth Lay has refused to testify to Congress on the collapse of his company. Lay invoked his Fifth Amendment right to avoid incriminating himself.
I am deeply troubled about asserting these rights because it may be perceived by some that I have something to hide. But after agonizing consideration, I cannot disregard my counsel's instruction.
Senators at the hearing used the opportunity to condemn Lay, calling him a con man and blaming him for the debacle that cost Enron's investors, employees, and retirees billions of dollars. Later in the hearing, an Enron board member testified that Lay and all the company's top management knew and understood that Enron was using outside partnerships to keep a huge amount of debt off its books. 5 former heads of the Securities and Exchange Commission were on Capitol Hill today. The group was testifying before members of the Senate Banking Committee on possible reforms to the accounting industry following the collapse of Enron. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Testifying before Senate lawmakers, former SEC Chairman Arthur Levitt focused on what he called an emerging crisis of confidence in U.S. financial markets. Levitt blaming questionable business practices he says have damaged the trust on which the nation's entire financial system depends.
In our highly competitive economy, more and more business leaders are employing financial maneuvers that approach and sometimes cross ethical boundaries.
Along with calling for clear lines to be drawn between consulting and accounting functions at audit firms, another proposal discussed at the hearing was that a new private sector board be created to oversee the accounting industry. The Senate hearing comes at a time House lawmakers are also said to be considering legislation to monitor the industry. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
The New York City Police Department is once again staffing landmarks, tunnels, bridges, and office buildings following today's terrorism warning from the FBI. Cindy Rodriguez reports from member station WNYC.
The police department says the city is in a heightened state of awareness and vigilance, and a spokesperson for New York's governor says everything is being done to make sure all New Yorkers are safe. During morning rush hour, the NYPD bomb squad made an arrest at the sprawling Port Authority bus terminal, a main commuter's hub that serves about 100,000 passengers daily. The suspect, a 56-year-old male, was accused of dropping what turned out to be a cell phone wrapped in wires near a police desk. Commuters at the bus terminal say they were not worried by the bomb scare or the FBI warning. Instead, they say the extra police presence at bridges and tunnels are causing long delays. For NPR News, I'm Cindy Rodriguez in New York.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street, and the Dow lost 21 points to close at 9,863 in active trading. The Nasdaq lost 12 points to close at 1834. This is NPR News. The movie Lord of the Rings received 13 nominations for Academy Awards today, including Best Picture and Best Director. The other nominees for Best Picture were A Beautiful Mind, Moulin Rouge, Gosford Park, and In the Bedroom. Nominated for Best Actor were Denzel Washington, Russell Crowe, Tom Wilkinson, Sean Penn, and Will Smith. Best Actress nominations went to Sissy Spacek, Halle Berry, Nicole Kidman, Renee Zellweger, and Junie Dench. With spring training just a few days away, Major League Baseball owners have approved the sale of the Florida Marlins and the Montreal Expos. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The approval sets off a round robin of changes at the top of Major League Baseball. The Marlins' embattled owner, John Henry, will sell the team for $158 million to Jeffrey Loria, the owner of the Montreal Expos. Loria plans to raise the cash to buy the Marlins by selling the Expos to Major League Baseball. With no individual owner, the commissioner's office has picked the Expos leadership. The new general manager will be Hall of Fame slugger Frank Robinson, who's currently a league official. As for the Marlins, Loria has hired former Expos manager Jeff Torborg as general manager. Loria says he's committed to keeping the team in South Florida. Meanwhile, outgoing Marlins owner John Henry plans to stay in baseball, parlaying the sale of the Marlins into an ownership stake with the Boston Red Sox. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
Emergency officials in Iran say they believe all 118 people aboard an Iranian passenger jet were killed today when the plane crashed in Iran's western mountains. The Russian-built passenger jet went down in rain and snow early this morning. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Warner Brothers Records, presenting Speaking of Now, the new album from the Pat Metheny Group. Information available on the web at patmethenygroup.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, American snowboarders won gold, silver, and bronze Olympic medals in the men's halfpipe. This is only the second time that snowboarding has been included in the Winter Games. It's quickly become one of the most popular events in the Games, especially among younger viewers. My guest Chris Klug competed in snowboarding's Olympic debut in Nagano in 1998. He tied for second place after the first run, but caught his arm in a gate on the second run and came in sixth. This year in Salt Lake, he enters the Games as the top American male alpine snowboarder. That's pretty phenomenal, considering that a year and a half ago he had a liver transplant, the only thing that prevented him from dying of liver disease. His qualifying run in the parallel giant slalom is Thursday, and he expects to compete for the gold medal on Friday. The difference between winning a medal or not is usually a fraction of a second. I asked what it's like to compete with that sense of time.
Racing can be very tight. I won a World Cup last year at Berchtesgaden, Germany by 1/100th, combined times after two runs. So, I mean, 1/100th is pretty darn hard to measure. That's
it's a slim margin, yeah.
It's a very slim margin. That's, you know, reaching your arm out a millimeter or less here or there. And, you know, that's racing. That's what it comes down to. And every little thing that you do, that extra bit of training, the nailing the wax just right on the bottom of your board or your speed suit or the way you combed your hair in that case that day made a difference. But I think it's neat. You're always just trying to go faster and faster and pick up that extra 10th or 100th or second.
So what's the psychology when you lose by that kind of real narrow margin? Is it easy to say to yourself, well, I lost, but gosh, I was close?
That's a tough one to accept. I fortunately last year was on the good end of that deal, but it's happened many times where I've lost by 1/100th or a few hundredths, and definitely motivates you to get out there and make sure you're disciplined about trying to gain every split second that you can. I think for me it's obviously frustrating because you know how close you were, but at the same token it reminds you everything makes a difference out there when you're against the clock.
Are there certain things that you do that you think, well, this can gain me that extra 1/100th of a second? It's nothing big, but it might give me that 1/100th of a second?
Oh, absolutely.
Like,
and that's what we focus on in our training. Things like when you're approaching the finish line, reaching your hand out to try and trip the wand versus just standing up and cruising through it. I mean, that can be a couple tenths, as we've noticed in training. Making sure you get a strong start out of the start gates. It's much like in snowboarding, we have a luge type start where you use your arm muscles, your back muscles, your lats, and try and get as strong of a pull out of the start as you can. Since we don't have poles, that's essentially your speed that's going to carry you to the first couple gates. So, you know, we focus on everything from pulling out of the start to reaching across the finish line and trying to gain every split second that you can.
How did you start snowboarding?
I was into skateboarding at the time. I was born in Colorado, in Vail, Colorado, but grew up in Bend, Oregon, and was an avid skateboarder in elementary and junior high. And when I was about 10 years old, I saw the first Burton wooden performer and backhill snowboards come out on the market. And my buddy, who owned a skateboard and bicycle shop, got a few of the first ones in. And I just sort of saw the snowboarding as skateboarding on snow. It seemed like a natural progression for me. And I was doing a little bit of competitive ski racing at the time, as much as competitive as you can be at the age of 10. But I got out there on the snowboard, and I was hooked immediately. and really haven't picked up my skis too much since.
What's the extreme end of snowboarding?
The extreme end. I think that covers a lot of things. I think what we do is kind of extreme. The speeds and the angles you put the board up on and racing head to head against somebody only 5 meters to the side of you going 40 plus miles an hour is pretty extreme in my mind. I think the big air competitions when they're flying 50 plus feet through the air, the border cross competitions when you're, 2 feet away from four other guys racing high speeds across doubles and whoops and bank turns and all. And then, of course, the big mountain stuff, riding 50-plus degree pitches in Alaska. That's pretty sick, too. So I think anytime you're really pushing the envelope and charging on the edge of disaster, I think that's pretty extreme to me.
Now, you competed in the Nagano Olympics 4 years ago. Things are a little different for you this time around in Salt Lake. You had a liver transplant last year, and so it's just the fact that you're performing in the Olympics this year, that you're competing this year, is amazing in and of itself.
It's been a miracle. I'm very lucky to be here today and certainly to have another shot at going to my second Olympics and pursuing my dream of winning a gold medal. I'm very, very fortunate to be here today.
Why did you need the transplant?
I was diagnosed 9 years ago with PSC, primary sclerosing cholangitis. It's a very rare liver disorder, which affects the bile ducts. And I think it affects about 1 in 10,000 people. And so I wasn't real lucky to have been diagnosed with it. But nonetheless, very, very lucky that I actually received a liver and made it through it and had a miraculous recovery.
After you were diagnosed, were you still comfortable practicing risky sports like surfing and snowboarding, knowing that in some ways you were becoming more frail?
It wasn't so much an impact injury that I was susceptible to, but more so just dealing with flu-like symptoms and struggling with the whole digestion process, and wasn't really able to replenish myself after a hard day of training. I wasn't too worried about actually impaling myself or doing any impact damage of it as much as I was the thing failing and being in a foreign place or something.
Right. How long did it take you to actually get the liver once you found out that you needed it quickly?
I was on the transplant waiting list for 7 years, and then when I was upgraded on the list to a stage where it was imminent that I needed a transplant immediately, it took about 3 months. And that's a very, very challenging time for anybody that's on that transplant list. I think in the States today, there's about 80,000 people on a transplant waiting list, and 16 people a day die waiting for transplants. So it's a very scary place, and I thought I was going to be one of those 16 that wasn't going to make it. Going back to the Olympics and pursuing my dream of Olympic gold was sort of the last thing on my mind. I was just hoping to get through it and live and be able to enjoy life with my family and my friends.
Do you know anything about the person whose liver you have now?
No, I don't know much about it. I'm starting to learn more, and I sent the donor family, a thank you note a few months after my transplant, informing them how grateful I was and how humble I was by their decision. And, I really feel they're the real heroes in this. Without them, I wouldn't be here today and certainly wouldn't have a second chance to pursue my dream. So it's a big goal of mine now to help spread that organ donor message and try and encourage other people out there to share their decision and to discuss organ donation with their families, because it does save lives. It can allow for miracles like I've been through, and I'm very grateful for that.
After your liver transplant, did the doctors try to talk you out of thinking you'd ever be a competitive snowboarder again?
I had an awesome medical staff at the University Hospital in Denver, and I was very lucky to have been associated with such a great crew. I think they never tried to talk me out of it, and certainly after my transplant, I felt great immediately. But they tried to remind me beforehand of what a major procedure this was. It's not a small surgery. They pretty much opened me wide up right through the middle after going in there and doing the transplant, and they just wanted me to be realistic, and I think they were a little skeptical that I had plans of going back to the Olympics and hopefully going for the gold. It had never been done before, so they weren't telling me that, hey, this can't be done, but they just wanted me to know what a big surgery it was, and that it's quite possible that I wouldn't snowboard again, or at least not at the level I was used to.
What were some of the things that you really pushed during your recovery period?
The doctors kept me on a pretty tight leash following my surgery. I was actually out of the hospital in 4 days, which was record time, and on a stationary bike and lifting isolated upper body weights about a week later, and then back on my snowboard less than 2 months later. So it was a miracle. I was so lucky not to have had any problems with infection or rejection. My body took to the anti-rejection drugs without any problems, and was very lucky I didn't suffer anything. But there was some risks. They, like I said, had to keep me on a pretty tight leash, because once I got that new liver, I literally felt better right away. I was still pretty weak, and obviously my abdominal muscles were all cut in half, so didn't have much core strength there. But, you know, I knew I was going to, for some reason, I just knew I was going to make it back. Once I woke up, I said, hey, this is all going to work out, and I'm going to be able to return to doing what I love to do, and things are going to work out. They were extra careful there once I got up.
Did you feel like you had a different relationship with your body after the surgery, because you knew how fragile a body could be? You'd been through this major surgery. You had an organ that had failed on you. You had it replaced. It's still a new procedure. And you knew that your body had limits, which is something I think you don't necessarily think that much about when you're doing competitive sports. You're just pushing and pushing and pushing.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. A tough one. I think it put things in perspective for me, how lucky I was to be out there doing what I love to do, snowboarding and surfing and kite surfing. And I certainly, I don't take a single turn or day of surfing or whatever it might be for granted anymore. But yeah, I think one of the most valued things, more than money or possessions or anything, is your health. And I just didn't know how sick I was until I saw the better side of things, until I had a new liver and everything was working perfectly. But without your health, it's difficult, that's for sure.
Are you more self-protective now than you used to be?
What do you mean by that, Terry?
Well, like when you're snowboarding, are you more concerned about falling or more concerned about even catching a cold, getting sick?
I'm not that concerned at all about falling. You know, I think if you ride careful and ride like you don't want to fall, I think that's when you do. And that's obviously, being tentative in my sport, it's not going to get you very far. It's going to get you a slow time. But I definitely a little more conscientious of, I think, just general cleanliness and trying to wash my hands all the time. And I'm on anti-rejection drugs now, so it makes me a little bit more susceptible to catching a cold. So I'm just more conscientious and a little more careful. But as far as riding and surfing and all the outdoor activities I do, I'd go for it even more than I ever did, I think.
When you're timing yourself in a race, how are your times now comparing to the times you had before you got very sick with your liver disease and had the transplant?
Well, Terry, every course that we run, what you do is you go out there and they groom the hill for us, and we set the gates on the hill. And every set is different, and every time you go out on the hill, the snow conditions are a little different. So there's not really a common gauge from day to day. You can't say, oh, I ran a 36 on this hill yesterday, and today I'm running a 36.5. It's always different. But I think the one way to gauge that is sort of how I'm faring against some of the top riders in the world and how I'm riding against my teammates. And I've been very, very competitive this year, as I was a couple years ago. I think even a little stronger this year. Mm-hmm. The earlier part of the season, I was kind of struggling dialing in my gear and a few things, and maybe stressing a little bit about the whole Olympic thing. But once I settled down and got my equipment dialed in, I was ripping as well as I ever have.
Do you think that competing in Salt Lake will be any easier for you than competing in Japan was, because you're more familiar with the mountains of America?
I think it'll be easier for me, actually. The fact that my home in Aspen, Colorado is only 6 hours away. The snow conditions are very similar. The weather's similar. This is where I grew up boarding and know these conditions pretty well. Whereas in Japan, we had a great hill. It was extremely challenging. But in Japan, the weather changes every minute. We had perfect spring conditions, ego snow. You could get away with doing just about anything on the snow on the first run. And then some ugly weather came in, and it was slicker than an ice rink on the second run. So it's sort of unpredictable, the weather in Japan. And I think I'll have a little better handle here in Park City on the conditions. I know the hill really well. We've trained on it and raced on it quite a bit the last year. So I think there's a pretty significant home field advantage there.
What are you going to do just moments before the race? Do you have any superstitions, rituals, prayers?
I always say a little prayer to myself that, hey, go out, do your best, and have fun. That's all that really counts. But I always, when I'm in the start gate, I always put a little snow on the back of my neck just to kind of say, it turns a trigger and says, hey, it's go time. Time to have fun and charge this course. It kind of just wakes me up and reminds me where I am and what's going on. And then I look out on the horizon, wherever it is, whether it's the Alps or the Rockies, the Cascades, or whatever country or place I'm in. I look out on the horizon and pick a peak and sort of envision myself free riding down that peak, just cruising and loving life out there, ripping up some fresh powder. I always take a deep breath and just check out the landscape, and then next thing I know, I pull out and I'm in the course.
Well, Chris Klug, good luck to you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much for having me.
Snowboarder Chris Klug spoke to us from Salt Lake City, where he competes later this week in the snowboarding giant slalom. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new hip-hop CD, Princess Superstar Is. This is Fresh Air. Princess Superstar is the creator of Princess Superstar Is, a new album from a white female rapper who writes, produces, and performs her own hip-hop with what rock critic Ken Tucker believes is a fresh, frank attitude.
Hold your breath when you see me walking by. I'm obsessed with movies, blah, blah, throw a stiletto in your eye. Ow. I confess I'm like Jesse James in the Ames parking lot. Have humans fun, pull numerous guns to consumers. Right. Your man freaked out. I told y'all get back. Book your 8-track, 8-dat, stole your Kit Kat. Grab your fanny pack and gagged you with the 6-pack. A 6 White Castle sack. Drip wax in your office bag. Change a few facts in your contract. Your fans is ass.
And A&R's gonna write all your new tracks.
28-year-old Conchetta Kirshner has been described in one magazine profile as a Sicilian Jewish fireball, which seems pretty accurate. Under her showbiz name, Princess Superstar, Kirshner offers up the image of a platinum blonde bombshell who can go toe-to-toe with any big bad male rapper and hold her own. She talks frankly about enjoying sex as much as she enjoys twisting rhymes into witty corkscrews. Here's how she describes herself in a bit of rapid-fire autobiography in Welcome to My World.
Okay, let me answer the question of the day. I was born in Spanish Harlem, then moved to PA. On 172 at St. Nick, food stamps are wicked, so my folks work themselves rich. If you want to compare me like white Lil' Kim, female Kool Keith, yeah. I'll speak and keep it simple. Here's your brain on Princess Superstar, pretty mental. Okay, I'm the Black Shirley Temple. I sound like every
Princess Superstar rattles off couplets like, I got sexist begging me to make me breakfast. And she crows, you're gonna feel like Chris Columbus when you discover me. And she's not talking about the director of Home Alone and Harry Potter. Indeed, coming upon Princess Superstar, who's no novice, this is her 5th album, is like discovering a new landmass in hip-hop territory. The white woman who may talk dirty, but who adamantly resists being labeled a female version of the foul-mouthed Eminem. Indeed, on this number, she resists comparison to all others and earns her egotism.
Like all my tracks are hot. Stop going on your web chat to try to find friends that everyone likes you, because you said you were tall, flaming like Dre over Ren, Cage over Amp, Rage over them. But how do you play Ken? I had no idea you were done with hip hop since you returned. You out your playpen rubbing body all over Ken.
What Princess Superstar may be best at is dramatizing the games, flirtations, fights, and wars that go on between men and women in relationships. and then connecting those battles to the ones she wages as a female artist, resisting the pigeonholes hip-hop assigns women. That's particularly true of a track like Too Much Weight.
Don't censor me, I live like a saint. I meditate every morning, drink carrot juice, I'm hardly late. Try censoring your candidate, gets head under the desk. If that's what you get, you can bet I wanna be the next prez. I deserve the best, and if you think my lyrics are incendiary, I'll go back to being an insipid secretary. Won't inspire no one, then the world will be safe. I'll just use words to talk about how Microsoft Word is so great. I feel bad that everyone's crazy and kids are smoking crack. I also feel bad that Michelangelo might have hurt his back. And what if there were no tracks for Shakespeare wax? For Flash, no word for Kerouac, there might not have been rap. Leave us alone, make your own family a better place. How much hate could we eliminate if you were down with kids' mixtapes? It must have been fate that brought me to this game. So let's game, use the platform for something more than fat farm. Sing about the bling bling, sing to help them out of Sing Sing. Turn your beepers off, ring ring. I'm getting sicker, here's the kicker. Your advisor stick, I'm advise you to stick the CD made by Seagram's Liquor.
As you've probably noticed, the music that accompanies Princess Superstar's declarations is pleasingly varied, more melodic than the metronomic beats that characterize a lot of hip-hop. She'll deploy an acoustic guitar when it's warranted, and her collaboration with the English singer Beth Orton is downright lovely. At one point on this CD, she tosses off the remark, "I got a vision itching to be an imposition," and that sounds like the truth. She's bursting with opinions and thought-out feelings. She demands, like a petulant princess, that you listen to her. And it's no imposition.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Princess Superstar Is by Princess Superstar. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Brainstorm and the pain's warm, swarm like smog in Hong Kong. I know it's wrong, but I kill myself with my own song. This magic wand could make it be okay. Kill the decay like a cake in a labor today. It wasn't a good day, and you can't touch me. I've already faded, faded away.
Sometimes I wear nothing on the outside because there's too much on the inside. The bouncer wouldn't let me in. He said my emotions were too close to the skin. And at this point, a touch would feel like a cut.
Turn me off, just turn it off. I'm off the base, off the face. When I think at least I cough mace. I could go on for days, but then I always complain. I waste a breath and a name. I aim and I'm aiming, I came here to choose. But when I look around me, compare me, I'm loose, paying dues, feeling blues.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools, 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, trombonist and composer Roswell Rudd tells us about incorporating the sounds of traditional jazz into the avant-garde. This great trombonist disappeared from the jazz scene for several years while he lived in the Catskills and played at a Borscht Belt hotel.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although he started off playing traditional jazz, my guest Roswell Rudd became the leading trombonist of the jazz avant-garde of the 60s. He co-led the New York Art Quartet and played with saxophonist Archie Shepp. He won Downbeat Critics polls in 1975, 78, and 79. In the 80s, Rudd disappeared from the jazz scene. He lived in New York's Catskill Mountains and played in the house band of one of the resort hotels. In the second half of the 90s, he reemerged. He's since reunited with the New York Art Quartet, Archie Shepp, and soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy, and performed with the indie rock band Sonic Youth. A couple of years ago, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in composition. He has a new CD with Archie Shepp, recorded live in New York. This track, a Rudd composition called Bamako, features two trombonists, Rudd and Gratian Moncour. How do you think playing with Archie Shepp today compares with what it was like to play together in the 60s?
I think it compares very favorably. In fact, I felt as if very little time had gone by, and I realized that probably 30 years or more had. But we were on the same wavelength and playing with the same kind of passion that we played with back in the 60s. Very, very emotional experience.
Roswell Rudd, although you became known for your playing in the avant-garde, you started off in a traditional jazz band while you were at Yale, a band called Eli's Chosen Six. Why did you first gravitate toward, you know, traditional jazz, early jazz?
This was the music that I grew up with in the house. My father was an amateur drummer, and he practiced to recordings of music from the 20s and 30s and 40s. And he had friends who played like this, who would come over occasionally, you know, wherever we happened to be living. He would scout around and find people that liked to improvise and play jazz. So this was the music that I learned from. And My function at the time as a child growing up in this was to dance, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was dancing and scatting while these jam sessions and, you know, playing along with the records was going on.
I want to play something from what I think is the first record you ever recorded on, and it's from the band Eli's Chosen Six, the band you played with at Yale. Was this like an official Yale band?
Well, I think we like to think of it that way because in order to sell it, we use the name Yale.
Yale Jazz Band.
Yeah. And this we would go out on the weekends and barnstorm at different fraternities all over the East Coast, you know, making 400-mile trips during the day between gigs and whatever. It was a good band musically. Everybody pulled their own weight, and we were trying to evolve a repertory. And over the course of the 4 years that it was together, you could hear that. You could hear a lot of development.
Why don't we hear a track from the Eli's Chosen Six recording from the mid-1950s, and this is called That Dada Strain, and you take a solo pretty early on.
Thank you.
trombonist Roswell Rudd with the band that he played in college, Eli's Chosen Six, when he was in Yale, and that was recorded in the mid-1950s. What was your path from traditional jazz to the avant-garde?
It was done through improvisation, or more specifically, what I like to call free counterpoint. That's what the traditional jazz had in common with what people were calling the avant-garde jazz, or the new thing that I was a part of in the early 60s in New York City. So that was the common element. And people always say, you know, how did you make such a giant step? You didn't play any bebop or anything. You went right from playing Dixieland to free jazz. For me, it was not a big leap. It was mainly, you know, having a good sense of what to do in a free improvisational setting with, you know, a couple of other horn players and a rhythm section, which is primarily what I did with Dixieland, you know, just finding a good part for myself and being able, you know, at the drop of a hat to respond to what other players were doing and find that golden mean through the texture.
Were there musicians who helped lead you in that direction too, who introduced you to different kinds of sounds or a different way of thinking?
Well, I think really the first musician that I can recall who was going where I'd never heard anybody go before was Cecil Taylor. And I was able to hear him at the old five spot back in the mid-50s with a great quartet that he had with Steve Lacy, who I still play with, and Buell Neidlinger, the bassist, and Dennis Charles, the drummer, who's no longer with us. But it was a marvelous quartet, and I really couldn't get enough of an earful from these guys. They really opened up a door for me musically.
Did you hear a way early on of translating what Cecil Taylor was doing on piano to what you could do on trombone?
Yes, in fact, I think at times I was trying to get this clumsy instrument, this trombone, to express in a way that Cecil Taylor did. Although I found it very cumbersome, at the same time, it made me strive beyond myself for effects that I had never thought possible. And my trombonist friend, Gratian Moncur III, who's on the Archie Shepp album that we did, that you played a track from, Gratian told me that back in those days, the thing that he liked about my playing so much was the fact that I was trying to do things that he'd never heard before on the trombone. And I think Cecil had a lot to do with that.
You were also playing things on the trombone that probably came from early jazz, but you were playing them in a very contemporary setting. The kind of smears and like distorted sounds that a lot of the early players, say, in the Ellington Band would get through mutes and through just kind of smears. Was that something that you were consciously trying to do, to take some of the sounds of early jazz and use them in this new avant-garde setting?
Well, I did need to have a lot more just theoretical knowledge to be able to play in the new setting. However, the traditional expressive devices that I had from the old music stayed with me and were more musically transformed as a result of further study in composition and arranging and playing with advanced musicians such as Cecil Taylor. Herbie Nichols was also very important to me in this respect because he played with a lot of traditional bands, great pianist and composer. And he also saw in me the fact that I had a great mammalian vocabulary, so to speak.
Mammalian.
Mammalian vocabulary.
What do you mean by mammalian?
Well, I mean, you talk about growls and smears and all kinds of vocal effects and or what's called gut bucket and dirty and so forth. And you have to realize that this is part of the basic vocabulary, tonal vocabulary of very, very much of the oldest traditions on the planet, not just the United States, but, you know, really old places like Africa, China, and New Guinea and so forth, Siberia, you know, the Eskimos, very, very guttural and lots of rasp and lots of sounds with tremendous edge to them and many, many colors. But I would have to describe it all, I guess, by just calling it very vocal. And then to put them into a musical format or a more musical context and make them function in a more symbolic way, that was the transition that I had to make sort of from going from Dixieland to newer music.
My guest is trombonist Roswell Rudd. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trombonist and composer Roswell Rudd. His latest CD is called Archie Shepp and Roswell Rudd Live in New York. Now, in the early 60s, part of the avant-garde was also associated with the Black Consciousness Movement. As a white musician, was it ever awkward for you during that period?
I was really inspired by the controversy and the energy that was coming out of the controversy of those times. And I was a freedom rider, and I was very involved in civil rights causes. And I just felt that what we were doing in the music, a lot of that feeling of the emotion tied in with the fight for civil rights and, the cry for justice, cry for equality, I felt that that was very much a part of my music all the time, not just during this period. And it was wonderful the way that audiences would be waiting for us to show up sometimes. You know, they'd be out in front of the performance spaces waiting for us to come, waiting for us to show up, because we were like a voice that was expressing their feelings. And then there would be people in opposition to this. And so at a lot of these performances, there would be the yays and the nays, and it would be just tumultuous and such a opportunity for growth and change.
Is that something you miss now? Do you miss that now, this feeling that the music is connected to something even larger?
It's still, for me, an expression of everything that you are feeling and thinking and being. So it will always be connected that way for me into all the different walks of life. It's just been so close to life for me, this music that I play, that I can't really make a separation between the life and the music.
Why don't we hear a composition and performance from the era we're talking about? This is 1961. It's a composition of yours called Yankee Know-How. How is the music we're hearing going to relate to what we've been talking about the time?
Well, I think you're going to hear free counterpoint, plenty of free counterpoint, and you will hear it at times sounding like a Dixieland band and at times sounding like a band you've never heard before. And in a way, I'm playing the transition from the old jazz to the new jazz, so to speak, in the course of this performance. And that's kind of the way that I had it set up conceptually when I did it. I mentioned, I think, that I was thinking about Charles Ives and some of the older Yankee composers. And how did I, as a younger Yankee, how did I fit into the evolution into modern times from what they did? You know that Ives was a great improviser, and most people refer to him as a great tinkerer with musical variables, and a lot of what happens in Yankee know-how here is about tinkering and improvising. So keep Charles Ives in mind, but notice that at times you've never heard anything like this before.
So let's hear your composition. I think I might have said it was from the early 60s. It's actually recorded in 1966. This is Yankee Know-How, a composition by Roswell Rudd, with him featured on trombone. That's Roswell Rudd, recorded in 1966, Roswell Rudd on trombone, with Robin Kenyatta on alto saxophone, Giuseppe Logan flute, Charlie Hayden and Louis Worrell on bass, and Beaver Harris on drums. Why were you gone for a few years? Why were you away from recording or even from performing in New York?
Well, I went into teaching, and that sort of precluded recording on any kind of a regular basis, but actually I had only been averaging about one record every 7 years before that. And then after teaching for a while at the University of Maine, I felt a need to get back to New York again, and I got as close as Woodstock, but really what I ended up doing was commercial work in a resort hotel, which was very good for me, actually. And I learned a lot about vaudeville tradition and show business and doing other things besides playing the trombone on a stage.
Well, the resort hotel that you referred to was the old Granite Hotel in the Borscht Belt.
That's right.
And I know during the summer, anyways, that the crowd there is mostly retirees, either from New York or people from Florida who want to escape the heat of the summer and come up north for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And I doubt most of the people in that crowd had any idea who you were and how important you'd been in the avant-garde. You must have felt like a real fish out of water, like somebody in a completely different environment, performing to an audience that had no clue as to what you were really about musically.
Yeah, the thing is with me is always to connect with them, not how they're connected with me. And I must say that the crowd at the hotel changed every week. You know, one week it would be the Polish police of Philadelphia, and the next week it might be a Caribbean festival from Brooklyn.
What were the tunes that were in your repertoire during that period?
Naturally, the emphasis would be on standards, show tunes, dance music. a lot of Latin music. And, of course, there was all this, you know, sight reading, a lot of different shows, special material with comedians and singers, fire eaters, puppeteers, you name it. I was composing the whole time. And I was inspired by a lot of the performances, just their energy and their experience and the new things that I was learning from them.
My guest is trombonist Roswell Rudd. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trombonist and composer Roswell Rudd. His latest CD is called Archie Shepp and Roswell Rudd Live in New York. Roswell Rudd, I think one of the things I love about your playing is that no matter what context you're playing in, there's this ebullience in your playing and this sense of humor and big heart. No matter how either Dixie or avant-garde the playing is, and I don't know if you have anything to say about that or not.
Well, I think the essential thing for anybody who's at all expressive with their personality through a voice or an instrument is having a sound, having an identifiable sound. And I think that's maybe what you're talking about here, that you sort of pick me out by a certain ring or vibration, a color that comes out of the horn when I'm playing.
That's right.
And this is the way it is for, I think, a lot of the really great all-time improvisers in jazz, such as Coleman Hawkins and Roy Eldridge. You know the ones, Miles Davis, Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, you can hear 3 seconds, you know, just a little sample, and right away you know who it is. And it's in the sound. It's in the sound. And then you can go on to say, well, it's in the choices, it's in the dynamics, this is his signature theme, you know. Then it can go into more elaborated means of identification. But the first thing that you hear, the sound and the personality coming out, that's what initially identifies anybody in this music.
Well, you're right, and you really do have a very identifiable sound. Is that a sound that you consciously created, or was it just the sound that you had?
Could be a prenatal sound. Could be a sound. Could be a sound coming from my parents. Who knows? It goes all the way back, you know. But basically, it's the first sound that I made when I was given that mellophone in grammar school, and brought it home and blew on it. And this phenomenon came out, and I said, damn, that's me. And then I went to work on that for the last 40 or 50 years, and that's what you hear, refinements of that.
Well, Roswell Rudd, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, Terry.
Trombonist and composer Roswell Rudd, his latest CD is called Archie Shepp and Roswell Rudd Live in New York. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a different version of the Roswell Rudd composition that we opened with, Bamako. He wrote it when he was in Mali. This is from a forthcoming CD called Mali Cool, on which he plays with musicians from Mali.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by Justin Cronin, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the Bush administration's treatment of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda detainees. We talk with constitutional scholar Cass Sunstein and South African judge Richard Goldstone, the first chief prosecutor of the War Crimes Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.